Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. America is plagued in so many ways by its original sin, slavery. We know it existed, we know our ancestors eventually ended it, but we're just beginning to take a cold, hard look at what it meant to be those who were enslaved and how it impacts their descendants and how it benefited slave owners and their descendants. It's a part of our history that is a bitter pill that many would rather forget about, but it's at the crux of so many of the issues we struggle with to this day and which seem far removed from the present, but in fact are not. Thomas Jefferson was one of the practitioners of slavery. Our nation's third president and the author of the Declaration of Independence, a document which proclaims all men are created equal, not only participated, we now know that he fathered children as the result of a relationship with at least one of the enslaved women on his estate, Sally Hemings. A few years ago, descendants of Jefferson and those of Hemings gathered at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, in a kind of de facto recognition of an uncomfortable historical fact. They mingled at lunches and cocktail parties, but Jefferson's descendants still have not totally accepted the facts of his relationship with Hemings. All her life, Gail Jessup White heard family tales of that relationship and claims of her family's ties to Sally Hemings and therefore to Jefferson. A TV anchor and reporter who also worked for a time with the New York Times, she started digging and discovered the truth of that liaison of centuries ago. She tells her family story in her new book, Reclamation, Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson, and a Descendant's Search for Her Family's Lasting Legacy. And she joins us for the hour. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much, Mike. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
You know, in addition to authoring this book about your ancestry and your connection to Thomas Jefferson, you are the Public Relations and Community Engagement Officer at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's estate. And you write that you've always felt pulled to that place. Now that you've been in the job for a while, has being there done something for you that personally, in terms of your search for historical belonging?
So the short answer to that is yes. And the long answer is this. Just yesterday, I was at Monticello. I'm not there as often as I used to be because of the pandemic.
Right.
We're open to the public, but a lot of us are working remotely. And as I live 70 miles from that site. I live in Richmond, Virginia. Charlottesville, where Monticello is 70 miles from here. So that's a 2.5 hour round trip for me. So I'm comfortable working remotely. But when I went to Monticello yesterday and I was walking around the grounds, I felt so at home and so comfortable and so happy to be there. Of course, it's beautiful. But for me, it's much more than that. I feel embraced by that place. When I walk around Monticello, I feel the presence of my ancestors. I can hear them. I can hear, and this will sound odd because we're talking about enslaved people. I can hear their laughter. I can feel their joy. I can feel their pain. I can feel their sorrow. I can feel their loves because their blood runs through my veins. And I feel at home there. And I'm happy. I'm happy there. And I'm honored to be able to share their stories.
Wow. You open your book talking about the bifurcation of Thomas Jefferson and his family and the enslaved people who worked for him, and many of whom he befriended, others he didn't take so kindly to. But how that bifurcation continues in terms of the burial grounds for his family and his descendants and those of the people who worked for him. You want to read some of that?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Thank you for asking. So indeed, what we've uncovered through this research is that the relationships that existed between the enslaved and the enslaver were multi-generational. It goes back to Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law and extends to his great-great-grandson, one of his great-great-grandsons. And there are at least two grave sites in Monticello. One is at the top of the mountain, one is at the bottom of the mountain. And I would like people to think of the significance of that as I read this passage. And this is the opening of the book, the prologue. It begins as such. There are two known burial grounds at Monticello, at least two. The estate that was Thomas Jefferson's home. One is near the main house and surrounded by an imposing wrought iron fence. It is populated with tombstones marked Jefferson, Randolph, Taylor, and the surnames of other kin. Jefferson's grave is marked by an obelisk adorned with an inscription of how he wished to be remembered. Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia. The graveyard is still in use. It is the only property on the plantation not owned by the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, the nonprofit that owns and manages Monticello, but by a group called the Monticello Association, whose members are direct descendants of Thomas Jefferson and his wife, Martha Wales Skelton. From time to time, members of the association gather for a burial or wreath-laying ceremony to commemorate their legendary ancestor. Only Jefferson, his wife family, and their descendants and spouses are buried there. Only they are welcome. That was made painfully clear in 1999, shortly after a white descendant invited 24 Black people to an association event, because they too can trace their origins to the third president. They were descendants of a liaison between Jefferson and a woman he enslaved, Sally Hemings. The cousins tried to integrate the 700-member association at their annual meeting. According to witnesses, a near riot erupted as white members, fueled by two centuries of denial about who fathered Hemings' children, furiously objected. The episode made the national press. There was my family being racist on the front page of the New York Times, lamented a white descendant 20 years later.
That's what I meant by not fully accepting the facts of history. And you mentioned Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law, and that goes to whom Sally Hemings was. Talk about right. that for a second, because this idea of intermingling between enslaved people and their so-called masters, owners, predates Thomas Jefferson. It goes back to the very beginnings of the institution, obviously, but talk about Sally Hemings and the intersection of Thomas Jefferson's wife and Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law.
Of course. So Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law was a man named John Wales. John Wales lived in Albemarle County, which is adjacent to Charlottesville. Actually, Charlottesville is all, they're all a part right. of that part of Virginia in the mountains, beautiful there. And he was a slave trader, among other things. And he owned a woman named Elizabeth Hemings. Elizabeth Hemings bore for him several children. And she actually became his concubine. And that's the word that would have been used during that era, by the way, after he buried three wives. So she had several children with him, one of whom was Sally Hemings. Elizabeth Hemings, who was said to be part African, part European, became part of the inheritance to Thomas Jefferson when John Wales died. John Wales had from one of his former wives, whose name was Martha, a daughter named Martha. It's very confusing, just so you know, because these names are used repeatedly.
Right.
John Wales has a daughter named Martha with a white woman named Martha. He has a daughter named Sally with an enslaved woman whose name was Elizabeth, and all of them became the property of all those people, became the property, the Black people of Thomas Jefferson, who marries Martha. It's really confusing. You really need a chart. When Thomas Jefferson's wife, Martha, dies, and remember now he's owning these Black people. When his wife dies, he moves to Paris where he becomes ambassador to France. Eventually, Sally Hemings follows him there to be a servant to one of his daughters, whose name is, guess what? Just guess.
Martha. Or yes. Sally. Martha, yeah.
No, Martha, yeah.
Because there are lots of Sallys, too.
Exactly. So if you're able to follow this, what you'll hear is that Martha, the daughter of John Wales, and Sally, the daughter of John Wales, were half siblings.
Right.
Which means that Jefferson took up with his wife's half sister after Martha died.
And to be clear, he knew that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Were you able to follow all that, Mike?
Oh, absolutely,
really...
yeah. The bottom line, the crux is that what you just said, that he took up, once his wife Martha died, took up with his half-sister, who happened to be the descendant of a liaison between Martha's father and an enslaved person with whom he had a relationship.
Exactly. You get an A.
Thank you. Your personal connection with Thomas Jefferson is not something that you knew about initially in your life, and evidently it wasn't spoken about a heck of a lot in your family, but at 13 years old, you overheard a conversation with your then grown-up sister, who had already left the house and married and lived all over the world, and her husband was a foreign correspondent for Time magazine, and she was talking about it to your parents. And I think you'd been to Monticello, or you'd been to Mount Vernon or someplace.
I've been to Mount Vernon, never to Monticello, but I've been to Mount Vernon.
At 13, you understood the significance of Thomas Jefferson and who he was and what his contributions politically to the country were. And you write in your book that your reaction to overhearing this was, no way, that's not the kind of things families hide. Or was it? Was it something they hid, or was it simply something they didn't talk about because why?
So, yes, not only did I understand the significance of Thomas Jefferson, was my favorite president. And it was principally because he had written the Declaration of Independence, and I really believed in America. I grew up in an environment that felt very safe and very secure. We didn't talk about race in my family. We didn't talk about racism. We lived comfortably, we lived well, and my parents chose to insulate us from that. I write about this in the book, how I would eventually learn about what it felt to be a minority in America, but I grew up not feeling the imposition of that. So when I heard my sister and dad having a conversation about being descended from Thomas Jefferson, of course I was astounded. And I was thrilled because he was my favorite president. But I did run into a little frustration and intrigue as I tried to pry from my dad exactly what the relationship was.
Well, as we go on in this conversation, we'll talk about how you were able to pry this over a period of time out of your father and why it was so difficult to get that information out of him at the time, and how you were pulled to Monticello all your life and looking back on it, the steps you took to get there, unbeknownst to you, as a matter of fact. Gail Jessup White is our guest. We continue in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins. Our guest today is Gail Jessup White. She is a descendant of Thomas Jefferson through Sally Hemings. We'll find out exactly how in a moment. And she writes all about this discovery about her attraction to Thomas Jefferson, the third president, also her attraction to Monticello, where she ends up working right now, as a matter of fact, as public relations and community engagement officer there. But she wrote this book called Reclamation, Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson, and the Descendant's Search for Her Family's Lasting Legacy. You learn of your family's connection at the age of 13, overhearing a conversation with your sister and your father. When you asked your father about it, he just said, well, that's what they say.
That's right. That's
and right. Later, he volunteers the fact that his mother was from Charlottesville and Jefferson was from Charlottesville. And then you have to use a crowbar to get the rest of the information out of him over the course of time. So let's talk about your connection, your family's connection to Jefferson through Hemings. And if you thought the explanation of Hemings and her relationship to Martha and Thomas was difficult, this is even more so, I think. So tell me about how you're connected to the family.
So it took literally 40 years to uncover how I'm connected to Jefferson. And it turns out, with the help of a brilliant researcher, now retired, her name is Lucia Cynthia Stanton, we were able to pull through old documents. I did some DNA testing, which I explain in the book. And we discovered that I am in fact descended from Jefferson. He's my 5 times great grandfather, but it's not through Sally Hemings. I was very disappointed when I discovered that, because for years, my sister's name is Janice Terry, and she's 20 years older than I am, 19, very specifically 19 years older. We were very disappointed when we discovered we weren't related to Sally Hemings, because we were, as thrilled as I was to think I was related to Jefferson, I was just as excited to learn or to assume I was related to Sally Hemings, but it turns out that I'm not, but I'm still a Hemings. I'm still a Hemings. But it took us years to really dig through buried documents and records and letters to confirm that. She is my four times actually great aunt, and it's through a brother. So again, it's convoluted.
Yeah.
If I get too much into it, it really will confuse people.
Yeah.
But in the book, it's spelled out very specifically. The book spells out exactly how I get from A to Z, step by step. It's a detective story.
Yeah.
And it tells you exactly what I had to do and how long it took for me to get there. And the first part of the book, which deals with uncovering this information, is really about my childhood and what motivated me, why it was important to get to this information. And for me, that's an essential part of it. It also allowed me in this process to learn who Thomas Jefferson really was.
Right.
So I said earlier that I was enthralled, thrilled to be descended from Thomas Jefferson. I didn't know Jefferson was an enslaver. We didn't learn that history growing up. Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and that's what school children learned about him. But as I matured in my social consciousness, my awareness of race and my awareness of racism, I learned who Thomas Jefferson really was, and he was a complex person.
You know, as I was reading your story and your attraction to Thomas Jefferson prior to your knowledge,
yes,
of who he was and what he was,
yes,
all about, and after you discovered it, and all of the research that you personally engaged in to find all these things out, I was thinking about how people have such difficulty coming to terms with the fact that he was an enslaver and that he,
right,
did have this relationship with one of the people that he owned, put that in quotes, and yet he wrote the Declaration of Independence, the most famous document probably next to the Bible in all of creation, that and the Magna Carta, which contains the phrase, all men are created equal. Yet he owned slaves, he disciplined them, sometimes not very well, he sold them. Had Sally Hemings been enslaved by another of the founding fathers, one who did not write those words, would we have an easier time coming to terms with this?
So I don't think that people have an easy time coming to terms with the history of enslavement and racism in America, period. I think that people hold Jefferson in a special place, but they also hold Washington in a special place, who also enslaved people.
He didn't write the words. He didn't write the words. All men are created equal.
He didn't, but he was the first president of the United States of America. So if we discovered that Washington had a liaison with an enslaved person, I think that people would be just as astounded and just as disappointed. Jefferson, because of his stature, does make it more complex because people treat him as if he were a god. People are often upset. People come to Monticello and they're upset about what they learn about enslavement and what they learn about Jefferson. It carries with it a kind of resonance that hurts more deeply when they learn the truth. But it's the contradiction of it all. It's the paradox of it all. It's the offense of it all, which is what I had to come to terms with, going from this adoring child of Jefferson and then coming to terms and facing him as a human being, who he really was. And there are things about him that I don't like. There are things about him that I disdain, frankly.
And yet he was a product of his time. And I want to talk about that, because as we re-examine American history, we're jumping through hoops to try to figure out how we should react to these people today, how we should consider them today. And I want to get to that a little bit later on. But this story is not just a search for who you are and who your relationship, what your relationship to Thomas Jefferson is. It was also a search for your father's family. He didn't know them. He didn't even know, I believe I'm right in saying that he didn't really know his mom's maiden name. She died when he was 5 from tuberculosis. Right. That's something that would seem important, to know her name if you wanted to trace the family history. And you spent 45 years doing this research. Why did it take you finally, why did it take so long to find out all this information? Why was everybody so reluctant to share?
So that's a really good question. And there was really only one person who was reluctant to share. And that was my dad. He just didn't like to talk about it. He didn't like to talk about his past. And as I explain in the book, it's because it was so painful for him. He didn't know enough about his history because so many people, including his mother, died. There was only one person who survived who was able to pass that oral history down. Mm-hmm. But this is important, and this applies to most Black people in America. Black people were treated like property. So there are no documents for most of us regarding our families until 1870, the first census after the Civil War and emancipation. So when we're doing genealogical research, I mean Black folk, we hit this brick wall. We hit this brick wall every time. You can't get over that brick wall. I am lucky. I was able to climb that wall with the help of Cinder Stanton and other researchers at Monticello, letters that exist because of Thomas Jefferson. You asked if other if people would feel as astounded, hurt, and stunned if Jefferson hadn't written the Declaration. Well, you know what? There wouldn't be as many records kept and protected and archived if it hadn't been for Jefferson and the Declaration. And for me, that was hugely beneficial because the letters are there about my family. Those letters exist. My family's actually written in letters that my white family wrote about my Black family. Are they included as background? They're mm-hmm. never a central part of it, but background in stories. And so, yes, it's because there's no documentation, it makes it harder, because people, Black people in generations before mine, were almost ashamed of having had enslaved relatives, because there certainly was some exploitation of women involved, rape of women involved, that people didn't want to talk about. My dad was a white-looking man. He did not like being a white-looking man and all that that represented to him. So of course he didn't want to talk about it. It was painful. And my dad was a man who kept his own counsel. He kept a lot to himself. And so he was willing, because I pushed, because I was the youngest, because I paid so much attention to him. And I needed to have this story from him. So I pushed and pushed and pushed. And finally, it just, the words just began to come from him. And he shared with me a lot of his pain. But my family is not unique in that, Mike. What makes my family unique is that I was able to uncover this information. Let me just add this too, please.
Sure.
I feel that my family represents so much of Black America. Because I know this, I'm lucky, but I would like other families to look at mine and see their own, because they have similar histories. They just don't know it. They don't know that history. I'm lucky enough to know mine.
The brick wall that you talked about is illustrated right from the beginning of your book when you talk about Thomas Jefferson and his descendants being buried at the top of the mountain at Monticello and the enslaved people who worked for him at the bottom. But where their graves are marked, the enslaved people's are just marked by blank stones. There are no names attached. So it's difficult to find out who is where and who actually worked there at any given time without going through these historical records of sales and things like that. And you mentioned word of mouth, these stories about history handed down by word of mouth, and that's pretty much how it has been done. And there's something called the Getting Word Project, which it has a connection to Jefferson and Monticello. Talk about what that is.
I'm so glad you asked that question. Thank you, because it was right on the tip of my mind. So thanks for bringing it up. The Getting Word African American Oral History Project was founded by Cinder Stanton and a woman who has since passed away named Diane Swan Wright. And the idea was to collect oral histories from the descendants of the enslaved. And so Diane and Cinder traveled thousands and thousands of miles across the country to speak with the descendants. And we call ourselves descendants. We're this group, and with a capital D. We know who we are. We have this shared history. And they collected as many stories as they could. And it became part of an ongoing archive that is stored at Monticello, which people can access by going to monticello.org and hearing these stories. And the thing is, the people at Monticello and the people who were enslaved there and the people who are descended there heard these stories of independence. They were always hovering around, weren't they? Working for Jefferson, working in the house. The Hemingses worked very closely with him. In another world, the Hemingses and Thomas Jefferson would have been in-laws, wouldn't they? So they're always around hearing stories of democracy, hearing stories of freedom, hearing from people in Washington, D.C. And this part, this democracy, this desire for freedom became a part of who they were. And who they wanted to be. It was their foundation. And so you'll see among the descendants, women's rights advocates. You'll see among the descendants, conductors in the Underground Railroad. You'll see among them newspaper publishers and social rights and civil rights activists. It's an amazing catalog of phenomenal Americans, not just Black Americans, and I think it's wonderful that Black history is American history, period, that is history, but incredible Americans who helped build this country. Black people helped make this country great, and that's one of the messages I hope people walk away.
Well, Black people built the White House, Black people built the Capitol building, Black people built Monticello.
Black people built Monticello. And if you come to Monticello and you examine that building, you'll see in the bricks, imprints, small fingers of imprinted on the bricks that children made. Children made the bricks, were among those who made the bricks that built Monticello. People need to know this American history. I get very animated with this because it means so much to
me.
Because in spite of America's problems, we have big problems in this country, and I don't want to get into all that right now, but they're obvious. But in spite of that, I feel this country is, if there's some great things about it, and there's some great people here, and I will not give up on America. I will not give up on the American experiment. We can't give up on the American experiment. We've done great things. We will do great things, but we have to be honest about our history in order to heal.
You write about going, for the first time to Monticello, and how you felt an almost instant connection with the place when you arrived there, and you took the tour, and you waited, you say, in vain for the guide to talk about the enslaved people who built the house. You write, their stories, I believed, reflected my own families and those of millions of people descended from the enslaved. They didn't tell those stories, but they do today. Were you part of the change? I mean, you were brought on to help toward that end, I believe.
So Monticello had been telling stories of the enslaved for many, many years. It was an evolutionary process. So when I came on, they were already doing work on Mulberry Road, which is where the enslaved lived and worked. They had the Getting Word Oral History Project for 20 plus years. So it's not that those stories weren't being told. But after I came on, I became a symbol. I became a very tangible symbol of those stories. People could look at me and say, oh, wow, she's descended from, well, I would tell them, from Thomas Jefferson and families he enslaved. Because as I alluded to earlier, I eventually did uncover how I'm related to him. And I just want to emphasize this. It's not through a direct, not a direct lineal descendant of Sally Hemings, but through another Hemings family member. It's so, the families were so entangled. And it's very important that we understand that, because again, Jefferson kept copious notes and we're able to access those notes. But what happened in Monticello is not much different from what was happening at other plantations in the United States of America. So there's lots of entanglement. The average Black family has anywhere from 10 to 25% European DNA. So I was part of the change. I didn't bring about the change by any means. It was happening, and I became a symbol of that change. And I'm really pleased I was able to do that.
But clearly, and I only have 10 seconds here, but clearly Monticello mm-hmm. wanted to make that change. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done
Absolutely.
It. What's their motivation in 10 seconds or less?
We don't have 10 seconds or less to answer that question.
All right, then I'll wait. Then I'll wait. Okay. I'll wait for the other side of the break to come back. I love throwing people under the bus. That's one of my specialties. Gail Jessup White is our guest. Her book is called Reclamation. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Gail Jessup White, the author of Reclamation, Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson, and A Descendant's Search for Her Family's Lasting Legacy. She is also the Public Relations and Community Engagement Officer at Monticello, where the Monticello Foundation has launched several initiatives to deal with the legacy of slavery and Thomas Jefferson's and Monticello's connection to that institution. Here's the question I asked before the break. What was their motivation for pushing in that direction?
So let me say this, Mike. That's a very good question. And as I said earlier, it's not a one we could answer in 10 seconds, so I'm going to take a little time with it. Monticello, staffed with very committed scholars, archaeologists, administrators, people who really care about history and care about telling the truth. It's an evolutionary process. It comes about in layers of unraveling history, which is not easy to do. You have to go through so many documents. You have to do so much testing of the soil there, for example. We were talking about that just yesterday to see who's buried there or discover where grave sites are. There's a lot to it. We are committed to telling that truth. We have taken the gloss off Thomas Jefferson. I think people want to, the public needs to know, and we want the public to know. We want to tell an inclusive history. We want to be part of the honest, forthright truth of who helped build America. The motivation, I suspect, is different for different people. And as I often say, I won't speak for everybody, but I will speak for myself. And that is a commitment of America learning who helped build this country.
Well, speaking of speaking, you were the introductory speaker at a summit on race hosted at and by Monticello. And in those remarks, you told the 1,500 or so people assembled from all races that you hoped that they would leave that summit with a greater understanding of how slavery shaped much of our country's history and with a hope for the future. And that speaks to something that we're grappling with in this country right now, well beyond Monticello: our history, how to uncover it, how to deal with what we find, how to teach it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have thoughts on that. There is, it seems to be, in some parts of the United States of America, this ostrich-like approach to history. Let's just pretend it didn't happen. Enslavement didn't happen. Racism doesn't exist. There was no redlining. There were no lynchings. There was no Jim Crow. Let's just all hold hands and pretend it's okay. But guess what? It's not okay. People are still suffering. Inequities exist. In some ways, inequities are more visible than they ever were. Think of the people who are dying from COVID. Think of the people who've lost their jobs as a result of COVID. Think of the inequities in our educational system. I just heard a report on Boston Public Radio a few days ago that said the average Black person in Boston is worth $6 compared to the average white person who's worth $250,000. Those figures are very difficult to process. Yeah. And I haven't checked to hear if that's true. I trust National Public Radio. I trust public radio stations. But as a journalist, you always want to have a second source. But I do know that there are inequities. And we have to teach, we must teach our children the truth so they can understand why these inequities exist. So Black children can understand that there's no flaw in their character. There's nothing wrong with them, that they're not able to succeed. A system of systemic racism that has existed in this country from 1619, before the country was even founded, but when the first enslaved people were brought here, has oppressed them, has oppressed their very being, has oppressed them physically. I mean, Black people are still getting shot by policemen, and in some cases in urban centers by each other. And some of that is because of the self-esteem that exists, the lack of opportunity that exists, all the things that plague us as a society. And it's, people have to get out of this idea that, out of these silos, if it's plaguing Black people and Black Americans, then it's plaguing all Americans. If it's hurting Black people, then it's hurting all of America. And we need to understand that and come to grips with that and tell the truth in our textbooks. White children need to understand why their Black friends might have struggled, what their struggles have been. It's not, the idea is not to impose guilt on anyone. The idea is to help people understand so that we can be healthy.
Because we do have this story that we tell ourselves as Americans about who we are and what it is to be an American. And you write in your book about being a child and faithfully reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, which contains the phrase, "with liberty and justice for all," right, and singing the Star-Spangled Banner, the lyrics of which contain the reference to the land of the free and the home of the brave. In your book, you say you trusted my country represented liberty and justice for all. Nothing I experienced in my young life had shown me otherwise, because you grew up in a middle-class neighborhood in parts in Northeast Washington, D.C., and really were shielded from a lot of the problems out there until a certain age. Right now, we have an entire political party that seems dedicated to stirring up fear and using this dog whistle of critical race theory being taught in schools as a way to drum up that fear. That's not what's being taught. It isn't being taught. It hasn't been taught in any school in the country. But it's still working to instill fear among people who believe that. And for the people stirring up these fears and for those responding to that at a gut level, is teaching and learning the kind of story that your family experienced down through our 300 years of history, is that what they're really worried about, or is something else at work?
I cannot speak to what other people are worried about. I just won't do that. But I will say this, that first of all, critical race theory is not taught to little children or to high school students or to even college students. It's a discipline that's taught in law school. It's legal. But some of our politicians are choosing to conflate that with teaching the truth about American history to divide us, to maintain power. That's evident. Or as my ancestor would have said, self-evident. My book, I hope, helps people understand what can bring us together. The history that I spell out in this book, and it's a history lesson. The book is part memoir, part history lesson, part detective story, again demonstrates how entangled, my family demonstrates how entangled we have been. We are related to each other. We are kin. We are blood kin in many cases. So my hope is, again, that people walk away understanding that there's been a lot of damage done. We've done damage to each other. Families hurt each other. But there's a means of healing. When I uncovered a lot of truth, I felt a great deal of pain. This book was hard for me to write. I felt my dad's pain, which was deep and affected me a great deal. I feel my country's pain. I love my country. It affects me a great deal. I did a lot of growing. I'm not young. So I've done a lot of growing in the years I have experienced living in the United States. But I have healed. This book allowed me to heal. And I pray that our nation will get to a point as well by being honest and able to heal process of facing a truth, a painful truth.
You have to confront perhaps some incorrect assumptions that were no fault of anybody's. They just happened to occur down through the ages, some perniciously so, but we've forgotten that aspect of it. We just believe what we believe because that's what we've been told since we were little kids. we're grappling right now with how to deal with what we are discovering about our history and how attitudes about our history are changing. What do we do with these statues and these memorials that are suddenly coming down around the country? And you live in Richmond, so you know all too well about that. How do you believe we should view these historical figures, particularly Thomas Jefferson, but others who professed to believe in the ideals that America says it's founded on, and yet who didn't live those ideals? Can we look at Jefferson with pride and the kind of reverence that he has traditionally garnered, or any of the other founding fathers, or must we reconsider those attitudes?
So first of all, the statues that came down in Richmond, Virginia, were of traitors. The Confederates were traitors. The statue should never have gone up.
But people have said, let's take down Thomas Jefferson's statue.
I understand.
Let's take people's names off.
I understand. They were part of a lost cause meant to represent those people who intimidated and threatened and destroyed the lives of Black people. And they were erected to continue that effort. Many of those statues are gone. As far as Jefferson and Washington are concerned, so these were very flawed people. They were very flawed. They were enslavers. You mentioned earlier that Jefferson was a man of his time. Well, you know what? There are other people of that time who manumitted their people. And Jefferson knew it was morally wrong. He wrote about it. He knew it was wrong. Thomas Jefferson said, among the most denigrating things I've ever heard, written or read, I should say, written about Black people in Notes on the State of Virginia. It's painful and hard to read that material. And I recommend that those who adore Jefferson read that. That will give them second thoughts. Should those statues come down of Jefferson, however, Jefferson was not a traitor. Jefferson was flawed. If we looked at other people, men and women, for whom statues have been erected, we would find flaws within them as well. So no, I don't think those statues should come down.
Here's what you say in the book. It is more valuable to see Jefferson as a human, to see him with his flaws, to know that in spite of his many flaws, that he still gave us the most inspiring words of humankind. But you say we don't have to venerate him, venerate the words, but not the man.
Is that possible?
Is that possible? Can people do that?
Well, as a descendant who once worshiped Thomas Jefferson because of those words and worshiped the man, yes, people can do that. If I can do that, someone who was very proud to have been related to Thomas Jefferson, yes, I think people can do that if they want to, if they want to be honest, if they want to get beyond the mythology, which is really difficult, but that's what we have to do, and get to the truth. Of course people can do that.
You mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation that there are tombstones marked in the top of the mountain that include the names Jefferson, Randolph, and Taylor. And it turns out that you are related to a woman named Tess Taylor, who is a poet who has written extensively about her coming to terms with her own family's history. And you turn out to be cousins. She's a white Jefferson descendant. And you met with her, and you both agreed that you asked her if she was looking for absolution for what her family did. And you both agreed that absolution is an imperfect word, but you agreed that perhaps each of you is seeking present tense reconciliation. Will we ever get there, do you think?
So more sage people than I haven't been able to answer that question, Mike. But it is my fervent hope that we will get there. If you look at Monticello as an example, you can see the changes. You've been to Monticello, and you said you were inspired by the stories you heard there that included the enslaved people. If that can happen at Monticello, a place preserved for the memory of Thomas Jefferson as an icon and a hero and a godlike figure, then that can happen in the country. But that's my hope, and I'm an optimist. As we used to say in the journalism and the TV business, time will tell.
Yeah. You close your book with this sentence. Every time I step onto that site that is now my place of employment, Monticello, I am reminded that it was once my ancestors' home, my home, Monticello. Since enslaved people built and maintained that house and lived there for so long as Thomas Jefferson did, isn't that feeling unequivocally accurate? That it is your home.
Yes. As I said earlier, I love Monticello. I feel embraced by the place. I feel the presence of my family there. I'm happy there. And I wish for other people to feel embraced by this country, America, that has caused so much suffering to Black people. My fervent hope is that other Black people will feel as comfortable and confident as I do.
And this book may help people reconcile this part of history. Gail Jessup White, her book is called Reclamation, Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson, and a Descendant's Search for Her Family's Lasting Legacy. Thanks for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.